The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Under an opinion from the Supreme Court Friday, Texas abortion providers can sue over the state's Heartbeat Act, but justices are allowing the law to remain in place. It bans abortions after doctors can detect a fetal heartbeat that's usually around 6 weeks. We spoke with Dallas-based attorney David Cole.
At the end of the day, if I'm a proponent of SB 8, I feel pretty good about where I am, because there will continue to be some federal litigation in the provider case, but it's going to be on a fairly discrete aspect of the statute.
Kimberlyn Schwartz is with Texas Right to Life. The group helped draft the law.
Every day that the Texas Heartbeat Act is in effect, we estimate that it saves about 75 to 100 babies per day from abortion.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that's big news. Hey, good afternoon. It's good to be back with you. I've been talking about this for a while, and I'm just on the sidelines trying to give you some commentary, analysis, and look at what's coming. We are winning. Life is winning. And the culture of death, boy, it's concerned right now. That was the conversation about the heartbeat bill. The U.S. Supreme Court, of course, decided to uphold SB 8. It was the Texas heartbeat bill, bans abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. And I just want to say bravo to you, Texas. Way to go. Way to go, Supreme Court. Way to go to you for praying. I mean, I'm so convinced in the power of prayer. You know that. I really believe you and I are the generation that will see abortion, at least at the federal level, fall. The fight will continue, but we will one day be a nation free of this horrible tragedy, this horrible scourge, this dark and ugly chapter in U.S. history. We look back at the chapter that was written in the blood of human currency, slavery, right? Horrible. People look back and think, oh my gosh, it was so horrible. How could anyone do that? I would never do that. I would do everything I could to work for emancipation. I'd be part of the Underground Railroad. I'd be an abolitionist. Where are you today for those who are even more vulnerable, so defenseless in the womb? We're winning. I know you feel you might be powerless, but I just invite you to always, always pray. So what happened? Friday, the Supreme Court, of course, in a divided opinion, they narrowly ruled that the Texas heartbeat law can remain in effect. And abortion businesses, of course, had filed suit against the state, claiming that they should be able to sue court clerks who accept the, you know, who accept and file the civil lawsuits that are the law's enforcement mechanism. And the law is unique because it doesn't rely on the state to enforce the law, but instead it relies on private citizens to file lawsuits against the doctors who do the abortions. And those citizens, they don't even have to be related to the women, you know, that are having the abortions, or to the child. They don't have to even be residents of the state of Texas. So the court didn't rule on that question yet, but it will more than likely come up. And the court did dismiss, though, the challenge brought by the Biden administration, the Catholic president, Joe Biden, and his administration against the law. He vowed to, remember a couple months ago, he vowed to throw the weight of the federal government and all the resources he had to make sure that, you know, abortion would remain just as lucrative and vibrant and as in place as it currently is. The court did allow abortion clinics to bring challenges to the law, and I guarantee you they're going to do that, right? They're going to do that. What are we talking about already? A lot of states around the country, they're seeing what's coming. You know, look, Roe v. Wade will fall. It's going to fall, and I think in June of 2022, you're going to hear the Supreme Court make that decision. I'll be shocked if it doesn't. It's bad law. But then the battle goes to the states, as we've talked about. Already you see states enshrining abortion, making sure, we talked about Governor Hochul, right? Wanting to have abortion tourism in our state, the state of California, so many of these other states, Newsom, another, I won't go down the path, but you see what's happening. This is just the beginning. This is just the beginning. We will be the divided states of America when it comes to life. But it's still good news, because that means that there are states in this country who will say, no, abortion is wrong, and we're not going to permit it in our state. So we're winning the battle. You know, wars are often won, you know, not in one fell swept, but they are a compilation of a lot of, well, many battles. And I think that's what we're seeing here today. You know what struck me, though? Here's one side note on this issue. I like to put my finger on the pulse of what's happening in the culture, because, you know, we get desensitized. I'm just as guilty of it. I mean, to a lot of different issues. Repetition, exposure to something. It might be vaccines. It might be mandates. It might be same-sex marriage, right? Quote, same-sex marriage, the redefinition of it. If you looked at the polling numbers before the Obergefell decision when they redefined marriage, most people were really against it, right? Today, the pendulum has really swung in the other direction. Well, with life, I thought, man, that'd be really hard to get on the other side of, right? Yeah, murder, the destruction of a child, that's just hard. I don't know how you can somehow justify, you know, with same-sex marriage, you know, there's a lot of people who can rationalize why that is a good thing and it should be accepted. Politico did a survey of 2,000 voters, and guess what they found? They found that a majority of the voters say that abortion should remain legal in most or all cases. 52% of it was a couple thousand people they surveyed, but 52%, it's a majority. 36% believe it should be banned in, they say, almost all cases, according to this is a new Politico Morning Consult poll. But Politico reported 42% of poll respondents said that they would vote for a candidate who didn't align with their views on abortion, compared to 32% who said that the candidate's stance will determine their vote. I'm in the 32%. You know, there's no way I could, in good conscience, put into office somebody who's going to advance that policy of death and destruction and damage on so many different levels. You know, it's very, very difficult to do that, especially if there is somebody who is not pro-death on the other side. Makes it pretty easy. Another 26% said that they were unsure or they had no opinion in the matter. So check out this. One final stat here for you. I don't want to drown you in them, but I do find them revealing. 45% say Roe v. Wade should be overturned by the high court. Compare that to 24% who believe it should be. So I've read that wrong. Let me give you this quote again. I have the document in front of me. 45% say Roe v. Wade should not be overturned by the high court, compared to 24% who believe it should. Now, those numbers, of course, differ from other numbers, right? Showing that there's either a slight majority who are in favor of the restrictions on abortion or a very significant minority, but like 48%. But you're going to hear more about that coming up a little later. I'll tell you what's happening in some Catholic colleges, too. But that's life. We'll continue to monitor it. We'll look at poll numbers and attitudes, but attitudes are changing towards it. And I think that really is, I guess, problematic. I was making my way back from Mass today, right? So I looked down at my gas gauge and I'm on, you know, empty. So I pull in the gas station and I get out and I fill up. I'm sitting, I'm waiting, enjoying a little bit of the sun today. I go back, put the gas thing back into the gas pump, put my thing on. I look up how much I just spent? And it's like, to fill up my tank, it's a small little tank, this car, right? It was over $50. Now, I'm sure for many of you in Chicago, or especially New York or Los Angeles, that's cheap, right? That's cheap. I filled my wife's car up the other day. It was even more, right? And I'm thinking, man, this is crazy. Take a look at gas prices. Take a look at your grocery bill. Have you checked out of the store recently? A lot higher, right? The Bureau of Labor Statistics, they released new figures on inflation. And guess where we are? You know, I was a kid back then, you know. We have nearly the highest inflation rate over a one-year period in almost four decades. Right? Four decades. Gas is up nearly 60%. It's up 60%. So I'm not alone. Grocery bills are up too. I mean, they say beef is up about 20%. On top of all that, one analyst told the Washington Examiner that inflation now is outpacing increases in household income and weighing heavily on consumer confidence, which, by the way, is at a decade low. No kidding. Look, I was saying this earlier to my wife as I saw some of these numbers. I said, this is just, how did we get here? You know, how did this happen? How do we go from a robust economy, a vibrant stock market, low gas prices, energy independent? How did we get there, right? Now, okay, yeah, there was a pandemic. No question about it. That certainly had an impact. But fundamentally, it's just bad policy. This is all rooted in just liberal policy, bad policy. And you can take a look at what has happened on the energy sectors, take a look at what's happening in supply chain. You know, we can take a look at what's happening across the board. You know, and as a result of it, I mean, take a look at policing, right? Let's defund the police. Everybody was championing that. You heard, the squad, all these different people out there. Look what's happening in those states where so many of them champion defunding. They're refunding police departments. They're trying to get more guys to hire because so many guys retired. They stepped down. There's a crisis in our country in that area. It's the result of bad policy. Bad policy. So bottom line is, you know, new inflation numbers, they're coming right now on the tail of a worse than expected jobs report last week, and the economy just added, I think, 210,000 jobs a month, far fewer than the 500,000 that was expected. But it's surging, right? Fastest pace in 40 years, up 6.8%, almost 7% from a year ago. I'm certainly outpaced your raise, I bet, if you got one. The spike in prices is affecting businesses and families. And look, we're on the eve of the holidays. Check out what NBC has to say.
Americans already slammed by soaring prices, now getting hit even harder. New numbers showing inflation surging to its fastest pace in nearly 40 years, up 6.8% from a year ago. Prices rising across the board, including gas prices up 58% over last year, fuel oil up 59%, beef up 21%, and used cars up 31%. All of it during the holidays. Dion King says his family has cut out restaurants and vacations and will celebrate Christmas without gifts this year because they cannot afford them.
The prices has gone up dramatically. It's just not in our budget to even go out and do anything for the holiday season of this Christmas.
And that really is the ripple effect of things, isn't it? You heard, hey, we can't go out to restaurants. We can't really even buy Christmas gifts. That's a problem. And we see this happening. You know, when the pandemic struck, take a look at what happened. I mean, the travel industry got crippled. I have a friend that is an agent, actually, and I don't even know how he's surviving. I think of dry cleaning. You know, I think of all the things that were affected by the lockdowns. And now you couple that with inflation and all the other things we're now seeing in the country, even though people are now getting back to work. People are saying, I can't make my ends meet. Therefore, I'm not going to do X, Y, and Z. And keeps us in this quagmire. It was funny because I was driving back, as I said, from Mass today. On the way back, I passed like three different businesses, and each one of them had a sign out saying, hey, you know, we need help. You know, we're hiring. And right next to each other, three different businesses, a food business, some other business. Everybody needs employees. And I'm thinking, well, where is everybody, right? Where is everybody? On another note, I want to talk about something a little bit different here. I want to talk about marriage in this country. Are your kids married? Or are some of them putting them off? Are they cohabitating? Married households in America. Let's deal with this for just a quick moment. That's going to come up in just a moment. We'll get into that, and I'll share with you. I'll share with you just some amazing. Stats, but not to bum you out. All right, let me take a quick break. When we come back, I'll pick up on something else I think you need to hear about. That is, and again, I don't want to bum you out here. I just want to give you put my finger on the pulse of what's happening. And we talked about, you know, defunding the police and all the rest of this other stuff. Stay with me when we come back. I'll share with you what's happening in 12 major cities around the country. A lot to get you just caught up on. Stay with me. I'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
All the news and issues now that are happening now.
One place. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Now.
Hey, thanks for joining me. Let me fill you in on what's going on. Just trying to bring you up to speed on everything from the economy to the battle for life in this country to what's happening in terms of crime. And again, I'll go back to what I just said earlier. I was reflecting on this over the weekend. I had a long drive, and I was thinking about it. And I thought, This is all rooted in really bad policy. That's where all of this comes from. You know, and that's why we need well-formed representatives, if you will, governors. We need well-formed congressmen and senators and presidents. And we need a well-formed constituency, too. You know, when we cast our ballot, you know, we have to have our hearts formed properly and our minds formed properly. You know, along with the inflation, there's something else going up, and that's crime. I saw some stats, and you might have heard about this last week. I didn't get a chance really to dive into it with you, but I think it's worth talking about. 12 major cities around the country are seeing a spike, in fact, to record levels in homicide. Homicide. We're not even done with the year yet, all right? We're not even done. According to an ABC News poll, or according to the ABC News probably, just in general, I forget where I saw the report. The data I saw said that these cities have already surpassed what is just to me a grim milestone for killings. Five top records that were either set or tied last year. One of them is the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia. It's a city. It's not, you know, it's not that big of a city. It's what, 1.5 million people. They've had more homicides this year than the nation's two largest cities. You're talking about New York and LA. That's an increase of 13% from last year. A year that nearly broke the 1990 record. 12 major cities across the country broke those records. Here's a report. Representative Dan Crenshaw with more.
American cities under siege by criminals. At least 12 major American cities have hit record high homicide numbers now. And it turns out Democratic mayors lead every single one of those cities. From the East and West Coast to the Midwest to the South, there has been a disturbing rise in violent crime this year. And that's putting liberal policies under the microscope. Watch Republican Congressman Dan Crenshaw.
There's a direct line between death and decay and liberal policies. They are deliberately doing this. They want prosecutors who won't prosecute. They want judges who will let criminals out. The criminals laugh in the back of a police car because they know that they're going to be out the next day back to committing crimes. This is a problem for people who actually pay taxes and actually live there. And they're absolutely ruining America's greatest cities.
And look, just to give you a perspective on this, it's not just New York, L.A., and Philly. It's not just the big cities. It's Toledo, Ohio, and Louisville, Kentucky, and Portland, Oregon, and Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Rochester, New York. I mean, there's Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I mean, you can go on and on. I mean, you can think of some others. Those are some of those cities amongst the 12. So why are we seeing this? That's a big question. New York Mayor's Bill de Blasio said, the overall crime rate is decreasing, but it really doesn't answer the question about, you know, what's happening with serious crime. And I've invited today a crime expert with the Manhattan Institute to give us some insight. It's a delight to have with me today, Raphael Mungwal. Thank you, Raphael, for your time. It's good to have you here. Thanks for your patience today, too. Good to talk with you.
Yeah, no, thanks so much for having me. Happy to be talking about this with you.
Yeah, give me some perspective on it. I mean, I'm looking at all these cities, and not just the big ones, as I pointed out. I mean, you're talking about small town cities in Ohio. Why are we seeing these numbers? Is it the result of bad policy? Is there something else going on? Why such a spike, especially in homicide?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is the result of a confluence of a number of different factors. But I do think one of the most important, if not the single most important drivers of what we're seeing with homicide is bad policy. Over the last decade or so, you know, in jurisdictions across the country, we have systematically lowered the costs of committing crime while also raising the costs of enforcing the law. Right. We have seen a broad commitment to decarceration as a public policy good unto itself. As a result of that, over the last 10 years, the prison population in the United States has decreased by about 20%. Arrests in the United States have decreased by about 25%. That latter trend probably has a lot to do with the fact that we've seen a sharp decline in the number of police officers on the beat. So in 2013, there were, you know, more than 710,000 police officers working in full-time uniform roles in the United States. That number is now below 680,000. I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, that trend has followed another trend, which is the demonization of that profession, which is really the front line in terms of crime fighting across the country. So, you know, and it's not, it's more than just the dozen cities that you noted. I mean, it is true that more than 12 cities across the country, small, medium, and large, have surpassed their all-time homicide records. But a dozen other cities did the same thing just last year. And things have not gotten significantly better in those jurisdictions. And you've got, you know, more than half a dozen other cities that are flirting with those all-time highs or with those 1990s numbers. I mean, Chicago is a really great example. You'd have to go back to 1996 to see homicide numbers akin to what Chicago has seen just recently. So this is a real problem. It's something that is spreading. I don't think it's going to get better anytime soon. I think things are going to have to get worse. But I do think that there is a line to be drawn between what we're seeing with homicide and bad policy.
I'm convinced of it. I really am. But I do want to give credit where it's due. According to the New York mayor, Bill de Blasio, he claims that the overall crime rate is going down and it's decreasing. Of course, homicide is increasing. So what's going on with that? Is crime going down, but homicide's going up? What are we seeing, and how do we draw those distinctions?
Yeah, this isn't something that we ought to be particularly surprised about for a couple of reasons. I mean, one thing, you know, New York City has seen a pretty widespread effort aimed at decriminalization of various offenses. Right. A lot of times that decriminalization is being undertaken unilaterally by administrative actors as opposed through as opposed to the legislative process. So we have seen, you know, police officers no longer interested in making arrests for marijuana, for making arrests for public urination, public intoxication, you know, certain other public order offenses like turnstile jumping, etc. So, you know, we've seen a lot of those arrest numbers go down. And if I'm not mistaken, de Blasio was relying on arrest numbers when he made that claim. The other thing, though, is that the pandemic really did change some things with respect to crime. And one of the things that it did was that it reduced opportunities to commit a whole host of various offenses. For example, during the lockdowns, you had a lot of people like myself spending far more time at home than they otherwise would have.
Right.
Our presence inside our houses made our houses less vulnerable to burglary. And so it's not a surprise that we saw a sharp decline residential burglaries during the pandemic. It's also not a surprise that during the economic shutdown, we saw sharp declines in commercial robberies because stores just weren't open to be robbed in the first place. At the same time, we saw an increase in opportunities to commit auto thefts as more and more cars were spending, you know, longer periods of time on the street without being closely observed or used. And so in New York City, Grand Theft Auto went through the roof during the pandemic. Wow. So, you know, what de Blasio is relying on are trends that are perfectly consistent with what's been going on in society more broadly to suggest that, you know, he had something to do with that one. But also right. He's aggregating various crime categories in order to detract, I think, from what is the more concerning trend. And that's the trend with homicide, aggravated assaults and shootings.
Yeah, no, I got you there. There's I've never seen this before, such brazen theft. And I don't know whether it's all organized crime now or you see people going in stealing products for $950 or less. Some isn't. I saw one man like walk into a Walmart, saw a video of this, or not a Walmart, some pharmacy, and he picked up his toilet paper and he picked up something else and just walked right out. Nobody did a thing. He just took it off the shelf and left because even if he was caught, you know, what was going to happen? But then you see these gangs of people, they swarm in like they're rodents. I mean, I never saw anything like it, like mice just scurrying over everything, shattering glass, stealing product and jewelry, and then getting into cars and racing off. Is there a distinction between the type of crime that we're seeing? Are some people just taking advantage of it, like the guy who says, I'm broke and I'm just going to go in and take some supplies? Or, you know, is there an organized element taking advantage of these liberal policies and you know, robbing these high-end stores?
Oh, I think we're starting to see both. I think we're seeing individual actors, you know, take notice of the fact that we've significantly lowered the transaction costs of retail theft in a number of different ways, right? I mean, we've seen policies like Proposition 47 in California, which sort of raises the threshold amount that you'd have to steal in order to be charged with a felony. We've seen progressive prosecutors around the country commit to not pursuing these cases of retail theft, their theory being, you know, that these are essentially crimes of poverty, crimes of necessity. But as you pointed out, what we're seeing is, you know, a lot of the places that are being targeted are high-end luxury retailers that are not selling, you know, things that can be considered necessities. These are, you know, gangs of people who are trying to take advantage of an economic opportunity to steal really valuable merchandise in order to resell it on the black or gray market.
Well, I only have a moment or two left for you. The solution to this, is it that broken window policy? I mean, what is the thing? Is it more policing? Is it more intact families? I mean, what do you see as the heart of this problem? And how do we fix it?
I think the first step here is going to have to be a law enforcement response, and that does mean more policing. It also means better and smarter and more stringent prosecution and incarceration. I know there's been a distaste across the country on both sides of the aisle for incarcerating people for significant periods of time. But I think what we're starting to see is as we walk away from that tactic, which played a significant role in the crime decline of the 1990s, we're starting to see a lot of these really heinous offenses being committed by people who could have and should have been incarcerated at the time. I mean, you know, I can't even count the number of stories of individuals who have been shot and killed. And then the perpetrator who's arrested turns out to have, you know, a dozen or two dozen prior arrests and God knows how many other prior convictions. These are people, who we ought to have incarcerated. And the fact that we've chosen to go a different route renders a lot of these cases self-inflicted wounds. And so I think we're going to have to reconsider that commitment to decarceration for its own sake and figure out a way to get police to want to do this job. That is a very, very troubling trend that predates the pandemic and shows no sign of letting up.
Hey, I want to thank you for your time and for your expertise and insight. If people want more on this, best resource is what, Manhattan Institute? I'm sure you're doing a lot of writing on it there.
Oh, absolutely. Manhattan-Institute.org. Check out our Policing and Public Safety Initiative. Scholars like myself, Charles Lehman, Robert Verbruggen, and Hannah Myers, Heather McDonald. I mean, you know, we have a team of people covering these issues. And hopefully we can see things start moving in the right direction sooner than later.
Well, Raphael, thank you. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it, and especially for your input here. Great to talk with you.
Thank you.
That's Raphael Mangual. He's a crime expert with the Manhattan Institute. You want to learn more, see what's trending, and get some insight and analysis, that's the place to go. On another front here in the country, and again, I'm just trying to give you, in this first hour here, a broad perspective on what's unfolding in the country. And again, we're going to pray in about 30 minutes. My wife and I were praying for something recently, and when it came through, I said, man, that chaplet's so powerful. And you know what she said to me? That chaplet always works. You know, it does. We're going to pray. And I just feel so drawn to pray for our country. Last night, I was awakened in the middle of the night, and I actually prayed for China, for Xi Jinping. I prayed for the Uyghurs. I prayed for many of the enemies of this country. I prayed for our country. And I just want to call you to that same type of action. Look, we're months away from midterm elections. I hope you'll form your conscience well, put in good moral people who have good policy. I'm not telling you who to vote for or what party to vote for. It's not about party. It's about policy. It's about principle. That's what this is all about. It's about principle. And then we'll have our general election before you know it. So there's a lot going on in our country. We might have hit a road bump or jumped the tracks a little bit here, but we can get back on, and it's not too late to do that. But, one thing that I think is the heart of this, nobody ever talks about, why we see the crime, why we see people not, why we see attitudes changing with abortion, why we see some liberal policies. I think we also have a breakdown in the morality of this country, and this country will only be successful. It's based on a virtuous people. And that starts with what's happening in the family. When you don't have intact families, there's a ripple effect to that. It has an impact. Back in what many people consider the American heyday, right? That was the 1950s. The typical American household, experts say, consisted of a husband and a wife, right? A married husband and wife, and then their children. And that persisted throughout most of the 60s. That's what family was about. Then it started to come under pressure. And you have to see where bad policy, again, enters in, right? Where things that stray against the law of God have a deleterious effect. With the advent of contraception in the country, the advent of the pill in the 1960s, You had also the Supreme Court decision, Griswold versus Connecticut, right, which legalized contraceptive use for married couples. And then you had California. So that was the 60s, right? In the end of the 60s, very end. What do we see California do? They introduce no-fault divorce. And then, like all things that sometimes begin in California, it ripples all across the country. Other states adopted it. In the 1970s, you know, the year California's divorce law took effect, 40% of households in the country, guess what? They were made up of a married couple with children. 40%. I mean, 60% weren't. Look at how that changed in just a couple of decades. It didn't take much time for that to radically change. And all that pressure, and really more if you think about it, it's left a mark on our country, and we're really seeing it today. You're seeing a real breakdown in the family. I know it personally. I see so many people. I've got nieces and nephews, and I'm sure you've got kids who are putting marriage off, or they're living together, right? Or you're seeing divorce multiple times. The Census Bureau reported last week that only 18% of the 130 million households in this country, 18% of the 130 million households in this country are made up of a married couple with children. You wonder why there's chaos on our streets? You wonder why we're getting bad policy? You wonder why this type of legislation is being put forth? You wonder why people are so acceptant of the culture of death? 18% of 130 million households. That's the fewest number since 1959. I don't like the trajectory it's heading. I don't. That's why I'm talking about it today. We can change things. You and I can make a difference. We can form our kids in the next generation properly. We can understand what marriage is and enter into it with a proper perspective. You know, the percentage of U.S. adults living with a spouse was 50%, right? Down from 52% 10 years ago. Over 37 million adults lived alone in early 2021. And one other stat here. That's, back in the 1960s, 87% of adults lived with a spouse. 87%. You can see the change. You can see where, the question is, why is this happening, right? A lot of analysts are pointing at things, and I think this is so true. And you feel free to sound off. Joey Pontarelli is going to be stopping by. I'm going to get his perspective on this as well. He's a great guest and a great author who wrote a wonderful book just recently. We had him on. Here's one of my perspectives. Here's what I've also observed from others. Analysts point out that there are fewer people going to church or believing in God. I mean, that's the bottom line, as simply as I can put it, right? I think that has a huge, huge role to play in why we're seeing this. What some of the more conservative or I should say temporal experts are saying, we got higher living expenses. But I can't imagine what it's like for young people today just trying to start life, you know? You have this penetration of just radical liberal socialist Marxist ideology in our culture. You got the LGBTQ ideology in our country. And some even fear that climate change is pushing this with people who want to lower emissions. So they just stay single. We can't have kids. And I don't bring up my kids in this life. I want to limit my carbon footprint. You know, and we got this weird mindset, this weird rationale for why people won't marry or have kids. But there's also the fallout from no-fault divorces we talked about. And I'm joined, as I said, by Joey Pontarelli. He founded a great ministry. It's called Restored Ministry. It's been helping people recover from their parents' divorce, maybe your parents' divorce. He's got a book entitled It's Not Your Fault. We talked to him either last week or the week before, and I thought, hey, he'd be great to talk to today. It's Not Your Fault is his book, A Practical Guide to Navigating the Pain and Problems from Your Parents' Divorce. Check him out at restoredministry.com. Joey, good to have you back. Good afternoon.
Drew, it's great to be back with you. I wish we could talk about better news. This is certainly shocking stuff.
This whole hour, I've been trying to give a broad overview of what's happening from economics to the culture of death to liberal policy to the breakdown of the family. There is hope, and you and I have talked about that in the past. I mean, you know, with God on our side, all things are possible, and if we're well-formed and we can be a witness to others, we can change the culture, and I do believe that. I'd love your perspective, though. Did I miss anything on how the culture is influencing people deciding not to get married and have kids? What are those driving forces?
Yeah, no, I think you covered it really well. One thing, I was reading some of the articles talking about the U.S. Census data that you quoted before about you know, 18% of U.S. households being where there's a married mom and a dad who have children. And it's shocking, especially how that's been cut in half since 1970. I think, you know, all these analysts are pointing to things like you mentioned, which I certainly think there's a point to that. There's a lot of layers to this, no doubt. But I didn't really hear anyone mention divorce in the conversation, which I'm glad you brought up because I think it's so real.
That's so true. How much is divorce pushing this? I mean, this is kind of your area of expertise. You know, you could almost call this really divorce when we see it, and the numbers are continuing to rise. A rebellion against marriage. I mean, what role does that play in this? Because, you know, people are blinded by it. They don't want to have the same. They don't want to make the same mistakes their parents had. A lot of people no longer, as I said, have faith, so they don't see marriage as a sacrament. So, what's it matter if I'm married? How much is divorce pushing this?
I think hugely. And like you said, I think so many people in my generation are just terrified of repeating what we saw in our parents' marriage. We know that we don't want that. We know that we don't want a dysfunctional marriage. We know that we don't want a broken family. And so often what happens is we avoid it altogether. We either tiptoe into it, as you're seeing so much, where we live together with, you know, our potential spouse or boyfriend, girlfriend. And we just delay this for years and years and years, thinking that that would increase the chance that we'll have a successful marriage. But as you know, Drew, all the sociological data says that by doing that and treating marriage like this game that we can just step in and out of, it actually damages society overall. And so we're seeing this ripple effect. And what I've seen especially is brokenness breeds brokenness. Statistically, young people who come from broken families, whatever the reason for the breakup, right? I know last time we talked about sometimes there's real situations where there's abuse or violence, and the people in that situation need to get to safety. But regardless of the breakdown of the family, it's having such a negative effect on society. And people like me who come from broken families, we tend to just not want to repeat that. So we avoid marriage altogether. And then we just have this cycle of brokenness. If we do get into marriage, we're more likely to get divorced. And so it's terrifying. And so I think a lot of young people, that's where they're at right now. They look around. They can't see many good examples of a great marriage. It's not attractive to them. And so why would they go after it?
Yeah, no, I could not agree with you more. You know, Pope John Paul II said that as the family goes, so goes the nations. I weigh very heavily those words. I wonder what it means for our own nation as I look at some of this data. I'm also a person of hope. I think good always conquers evil. I lived during the 1940s as the Second World War was raging and there were concentration camps and atomic bombs going off. Or I lived during the Cold War. I mean, it's easy to give in to fear. I also have hope. But John Paul II, he lived through all that. Yeah. He says as the family goes, so goes the nation. What are your thoughts? What does that portend for our own nation?
Yeah, no, great question. I think another way to say what he said, which he said so well, is our nations all around the world reflect the conditions of the families within them. And so, like, if we have broken families in our nation, then our culture is going to be very broken. And what we've seen from sociological data, Drew, as you know well, is the best environment for a child to grow up in is a family where there's a mom and a dad who love each other and stay together. It's super clear. I was just looking at a study from the National Library of Medicine. The U.S. government runs that. And they were saying how that is the best environment for a child to grow up in. And if we don't come from that, then we're more likely to repeat that. We're more likely to struggle with negative effects like behavioral problems, emotional problems, and so on. And so Elon Musk was commenting on a lot of these findings. And he said, if we don't start having children, our society will crumble. And I would just add one thing. I think that's absolutely true. I would say if we don't fix the family, our society will crumble. But there is so much hope. And I love seeing people who come from broken families who just rely on God's grace more than their own strength. They're actively seeking to heal and to grow so that they can go on and live God's plan for their lives, which for most of them, that looks like marriage and family. And so the good is getting better. The bad is getting worse. And so we need to double down and do everything we can to fight for the family.
You got it. Well, Joey, stay with me. My guest today, Joey Pontarelli, we're taking a look at married households in America. And if you want to join us, feel free to dial in. The number here is 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Just putting our finger on the pulse of what's happening in so many different sectors of of the country and really the world and what the solution is. Chaplain's also coming up in about 15 minutes. We'll pray for it all then. Stay with me. Hi, Drew Mariani here. Hey, I am traveling to the Holy Land in February with our underwriting sponsor, Nativity Pilgrimage. Information is available at relevantradio.com/Holy Land. That's relevantradio.com/Holy Land.
Most recent was that given to Sister Lucia of Fatima, who died just as recently as 2005. She was one of the three visionaries of Fatima, Portugal. It took place way back in 1917. And she writes, "The final battle between the Lord and the reign of Satan will be about marriage and the family. Don't be afraid," she added, "because anyone who operates for the sanctity of marriage and the family will always be contended and opposed in every way, because this is the decisive issue." We can see it playing out in the media, in the entertainment, in our politics, in our churches, and in our homes. The entire church is founded on the domestic church. Parents are the first teachers of their children in the faith, and that is a bond that's founded on their I do, which ultimately is the I do of Christ himself.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That was a homily in 2015 from the Synod on Matrimony, reminding us of those very powerful words from Sister Lucia de Santos, one of the Fatima seers, that the final battle of Satan would be between marriage and family. And as you heard there, it is now playing out. And I hope that if you are planning to get married, you understand the sacramentality of it. If you have been the victim of divorce, I hope you know that there is healing. I hope that, we really understand how much Satan on a spiritual level hates the family, how much he hates marriage. And if you want a good read, you might want to check out the book by my guest today, Joey Pontarelli. He founded Restored Ministry, and he's been helping people recover from their parents' divorce. He's got a book out entitled It's Not Your Fault, A Practical Guide to Navigating the Pain and Problems of Your Parents' Divorce, and it's available at that website. Joey, it's good to have you back. I know we only have a couple moments here, but your thoughts on those prophetic words of Sister Lucia de Santos to Cardinal Caffaro, which we just heard requoted there, on how much Satan hates both marriage and family.
He hates it more than anything, I think. And John Paul II, in the Theology of the Body and other places that he's written, says that basically the family, a husband and wife who love each other, stick together, and their child most perfectly, or I guess the least inadequately, reflects God's love for us and the nature of God. And so I think it's something that the devil hates. And since the beginning, he's been trying to spoil it, even in the garden. And so it's no surprise that he's continuing to just attack it at every angle. And all you need to do, Drew, as you know, is just look around to see how many marriages are falling apart, how many families are really struggling for proof.
You know, how is the redefinition of marriage, you know, and we've seen that in this country, affected people's perspective on it? You know, we're seeing abortion numbers change, people becoming more accepting, which to me is shocking. But we certainly saw after the Supreme Court's decision that redefined marriage, the Obergefell decision, people were opposed to you know, a man marrying a man, a woman marrying a woman. Now attitudes have radically changed. So does this LGBTQ mindset influence people against getting married? Does it change the perspective, or does it say all the more, hey, marriage is a good thing and we should have it? Because there's this push for so-called, quote, marriage equality, you know, that some claim would strengthen the institution of marriage. Does it do that, or does it undermine it?
I think it does undermine it, but I think we can drill a little bit deeper on that. And I think it's overall, even on the heterosexual side, we've lost the definition of marriage. We've lost the purpose of marriage. So many of us in our culture, and I think this is very prevalent today, we believe that the purpose of marriage is our own personal happiness. But that's not the purpose of marriage. The purpose of marriage is for holiness. And it's especially for the procreation education of children. And so once we get divorced from that idea, from that belief that we have as Catholics, the further that we're going to fall into disarray, into just the disaster that we see in our world today.
Well, let's do this. Let's grab some calls. We have a few moments. I'm grateful for everyone who's waiting to join the conversation. We'll start first with Ruth. She's listening in Westchester, Illinois. Hi, Ruth. Good afternoon.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment.
All right. Let's try that again. Hang on a second. Ruth, hang on. There you go. Go ahead, Ruth. All
right. Came from a broken home. My future husband also came from a broken home. All through high school, I prayed to St. Jude for a good husband and a good marriage. Bottom line, 56 years married when he passed away. Raised four sons, all married more than 25 years. 10 grandchildren. None of this happened without trauma and a lot of faith, a lot of trust in God. And, of course, my beloved St. Jude has always been my go-to person. And I wouldn't do it any other way. I am so grateful and thankful for my faith and for my trust in God.
Well, thank you, Ruth, for that beautiful call. We're grateful for it.
Beautiful.
So there's a testimony for you, Joey, huh? I mean, 56 years married and 24 kids married, 25 years each. So
wow.
She's right about the trials and the tribulations that marriages will endure, families will endure. Your advice, very quickly on that, I want to go to Todd in Lexington. If someone's going through a troubled marriage right now, I mean, what advice would you give to them rather than throwing in the towel and moving on? Again, if it's abusive, you got to get out. But I want your perspective on maybe change of attitude, or what advice would you give to somebody in that situation?
Yeah, I think the first thing is even the most impossible situations have a solution if we give them enough time and we work at it. And one resource I just want to mention to people, friends of mine, Greg and Julie Alexander, they run the Alexander House. It's an incredible ministry to help couples who are just on the point of despair. And Drew, you'll be shocked at this. Over the last 20 years, they've helped over 5,000 couples. Their success rate at keeping the marriage together and helping the couple heal, 98%.
I know.
It's fantastic.
We've had them on the air, Joey. I mean, the numbers are off the charts. I'm thinking it's insane, isn't it? It's crazy.
It's beautiful. So, make use of resources like that. We need to help each other. Yeah. But I think just honestly the belief that it's possible to persevere, and then hearing stories of couples who've done it, like Ruth, who came from a broken family. Maybe she had some struggles in her marriage, but she persevered and it got better over time. And that's what some of the research suggests too. If you can persevere through those difficult times, you're going to have a stronger marriage eventually. It might take some time, but Layla Miller, Drew, I think you've spoken with her before. She has an incredible book called Impossible Marriages Redeemed, Impossible Marriages Redeemed. It just features stories of couples who were really at the point of despair in their marriage, but through God's grace, they're able to heal the marriage.
Hey, Todd in Lexington, sorry you only got a couple minutes, but go right ahead.
I am curious. I've heard that couples who cohabitate, when they do get married, have a higher divorce rate than couples who don't cohabitate and get married without doing that. Is that true?
Yeah,
Are
I could dive in
that.
There.
I was. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry, Drew, didn't mean to cut in there. So there's different estimates. There's different studies on that, but one consistent that's come back is that that's exactly true. That couples who do live together before marriage tend to have a higher divorce rate. Some estimates go up to 50 to 80% higher. And so there's been different universities that have studied this. For example, the universities of Chicago and Michigan, and so on. So it's certainly a topic that we can get into. There's many layers to it, but that is absolutely true according to the studies out there right now.
You know, Todd, we've literally less than a minute to go here, but I will address this at some point in the future. The data is out there, as my guest Joey Pontarelli has pointed out. And if you're cohabitating, the chance of, a successful marriage diminishes, unfortunately. But I'll tell you what, when we come back, we'll pray the chapel, we'll pray for marriage, we'll pray for our country. Check out Joey Pontarelli's book one final time. You can find it at restoredministry.com. It's called It's Not Your Fault. Joey, thank you for your time. We'll catch back up again, okay?
Thanks so much, Drew. Pleasure to be with you.
You got it. Stay with us. The chaplain is straight ahead.